Wholly appropriate today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. The White House says President Trump didn't do anything wrong when he disclosed classified information to Russia's ambassador and foreign minister. Trump's national security advisor says
the president in no way compromised any sources or methods in the course of this conversation.
But that's not how this former CIA director sees it.
It appears as if the president, probably out of ignorance or disinterest, went ahead and told Lavrov and Kisiak something that was not ours to share.
Also, the history of ransomware attacks. Not many remember the first one back in the late 1980s.
Nobody ever heard of it, right? I mean, have you ever heard of it? This is, you know, got buried by the sands of time.
Those stories ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and you're with The World. Thanks for being with us. Lots to get to today. But let's start with this. A sitting president of the United States passed along classified information to the Russians. That's exactly what The Washington Post and now others are saying President Trump did during a recent meeting with Russian officials. While White House officials first denied it, the president himself, in a morning tweet storm, defended his sharing of information with the Russians. And at a press conference today, National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster spoke up for his boss. We condensed it for you. You'll get the idea.
What the president discussed with the foreign minister was wholly appropriate to that conversation. It's wholly appropriate for the president to share whatever information in which it was wholly appropriate to share what the threat was. He shares information in a way that is wholly appropriate. So I wanted to make clear to everybody that the president in no way compromised any sources or methods in the course of this conversation.
The real issue, McMaster said, was who leaked this information to the press. McMaster was also pressed on what country had originally passed along the information to the U.S., but he wouldn't say. The New York Times is quoting administration officials as saying the source of the classified material is Israel. Let's start with a man steeped in keeping secrets. He's General Michael Hayden, former head of both the NSA and the CIA. Hayden says President Trump can give classified information to Russians.
Look, totally within his authority as president, our Constitution gives an awful lot of space to the commander-in-chief, and he is the ultimate declassification authority. What I'm more concerned about is not about the powers of the president. It's about the person and the performance of this president. Legal, yes. Good idea? Maybe not. And it looks as if this wasn't a well-thought-out, staffed option that the president exercised, but a spur-of-the-moment thing, acting as he often does spontaneously and with not much regard to the normal processes and protocols that have governed the office of the president. So that's worrisome.
What are the possible repercussions of this disclosure for the U.S. and its allies?
Well, first of all, you've got a sources and methods concern. And I know, look, H.R. McMaster is a wonderful officer, and he's pointed out that there was no specific discussion of sources and methods. But, Carol, while I was in government, I talked to an awful lot of folks in your profession who would have stories, all right? And they would have the fact of and say the fact of doesn't put your sources and methods at risk. And I said, no, yes, it does, because the fact of very often leads to the fact how, or points in the direction of how we have collected this information. So even though sources and methods weren't discussed, that doesn't mean that they weren't put at risk. So that's one concern. The other concern is simply if the newspaper accounts are correct, this wasn't our stuff. We don't have the authority to share with a third party something given to us by one of our other friends. That is an ironclad concept called the third party rule, and we just don't violate it. It appears as if the president, probably out of ignorance or disinterest, went ahead and told Lavrov and Kisiak something that was not ours to share.
What's bound to be the repercussions of that, given what you said, disclosing information from a source that you're not supposed to do that? So what are the repercussions, possible repercussions of that?
If you do this often enough, the second party isn't going to be giving you this stuff in the future because you cannot promise them that you will control it consistent with how they would have controlled it, with how they would have wanted it controlled. So it leads to an erosion of trust and ultimately to an erosion of the kind of information that good partners make available to us. And so it's just a bad example. Now, the exact repercussions of this, I don't know the details. I don't know the country. And so it's hard to tell.
If you were at the White House and you had some leverage over how things go, what would you do at this point?
I would work really, really hard to make the president pay attention. The president acts instinctively. He's got kind of this a priori knowledge, he believes, at how the world works. And yet you've got this vast government out there that's designed only to make him wiser, only to make him more successful. We're talking about, for want of a better term, Carol, telling him to do his homework, to sit down with him, to walk him through the things that could likely come up, what the bureaucracy recommends he make his major talking points, what the bureaucracy recommends he does or does not say, to take full advantage of that. Frankly, I think there's no malice involved in here, no attempt to spill American secrets. But what you had was somebody who is very inexperienced with governing and yet seems to have no sense of humility in the face of his own inexperience.
Why do you think that that's not happening?
Well, one would hope that we're going to get a second bite at the apple, that the good folks, and I know many of the people on the NSC staff, they would privately, I think, agree with what I just said in terms of that's how the process should work. Here's the way to put it, Carol, that the president is attached to the broader government that's committed to his success.
There are strategic ways a president might carefully select intelligence to share with a partner, that a partner like Russia that you don't consider a true ally. How would you do that in that case?
I would certainly get a range of views, get people who have equities in this, people who are stakeholders, and into a conversation, let the National Security Council staff weigh the merits and present the president with a variety of options. And you're right, we do this a lot. And in this case, since it was a terrorist threat, there is just lurking off stage, Carol, this compelling requirement of a duty to warn in terms of dangers to maybe Russian citizens as well. So I get all of that. But if the newspaper accounts are true, this wasn't thought through. It was spontaneous and had, frankly, more to do with bragging about American intelligence prowess than it did with any careful consideration of what we have a duty to tell the Russians about.
What are you most concerned about at this point?
Number one, to get the professionals, and here I talk about people who are good friends of mine, H.R. McMaster, the National Security Advisor, his deputy, and others, get them out of the arena in terms of defending the president. Get them back into the background so that they can serve the president and the tasks for which those positions were designed, which is getting good advice to the president, not defending him publicly. That task belongs to somebody else in the West Wing.
What else?
Well, back to the book, so to speak, in terms of working really hard to get into the mind of the president. Carol, let me be really, really candid, all right? All presidents are different. The intelligence guys, the National Security Council folks, they have to adapt to the way the president learned. President Bush learned in the conversation. I mean, he read. But we would go in there and you could tell that the real learning was going on in the give and take of a very lively conversation.
And this is George W. Bush.
George W., yeah. President Obama, far more reflective. I think he learned in the quiet moment. He liked to read. The people now in government, Mike Pompeo at CIA, Dan Coats at DNI, H.R. McMaster at NSC, they've got to determine how this president learns.
In your career, have you ever seen something like this happen?
I've searched my memory, and so far I've not come up with anything like this at all, where you seem to have had a spontaneous, unrehearsed, unprepared decision in the midst of a dialogue with an international adversary. I mean, it's not like he's whispering this to Theresa May, all right, that clearly put the bureaucracy on its back foot. Otherwise, you would not have had the NSC staff, according to accounts, calling NSA and CIA, saying, we got to let you know something here.
General Michael Hayden is the former director of the CIA and NSA. He served two presidents, Bill Clinton and George W. Bush, in key national security posts. Thanks so much, General Hayden.
Thanks, Carol.
It's nonsense. That's how Russian officials are responding to the notion that Donald Trump passed them classified information. And besides, the U.S. and Russia are both fighting ISIS, so Trump should loop in the Russians, right?
Russia would like Americans to think that we're on the same side in the war against ISIS, but that's not really the case.
Julia Yaffe is a staff writer for The Atlantic.
So when Russia first went into Syria in September of 2015, they were mostly bombing targets that were not ISIS targets. They were bombing
other groups, including groups that were backed by the CIA. There were only a handful of hits on ISIS, and the impression was that they were just kind of putting a check mark there to show that they were, you know, pro forma going after ISIS.
You wrote recently that Putin has a history of offering to cooperate with the West when it comes to counterintelligence. What's Putin's strategy?
His strategy is to offer cooperation on counterterrorism, because nobody can really say no to that. Who doesn't think that two heads are better than one? More than anything for Putin, is it's his way back into the arms of the West. It's his way back in from the isolation in which he found himself after he invaded Ukraine and annexed Crimea, breaking international law and bringing down international sanctions on his head.
Leaks and reports of connections between the Trump administration and Russia, they seem to be growing. Is Russia benefiting from the chaos?
Absolutely. Look, they didn't expect that he would actually win. They thought Hillary Clinton would win and that they would just rock the boat enough that it would start sprouting leaks, that she would have a hard time governing because of all the work they had done to undermine her legitimacy and the legitimacy of the system. A lot of this is done for internal consumption in Russia, and there's still a big cross-section of people who want to live like in the West. And with this, Putin is showing them, you know, you want to live in the West, but take a look at the West. Are they any better than us? Are they any less corrupt than us? No. So why don't you root for your own team?
What are Russia's long-term goals here in this whole sort of protracted mating dance with the West and within the international community?
I think, as somebody once brilliantly put it, Russia wants a seat at the table and to be taken seriously as a powerful player. But it gets a seat at the table not by bringing itself up to the level of the table, but by taking the table down a few notches down to its level.
But ultimately, that's not going to be very effective if Russia's objectives are contrary to the international community's objectives.
I don't think Putin thinks that far ahead. And so far, he's been pretty successful. You know, this year in Russia, state media and people loyal to the Kremlin marked the 10th anniversary of Vladimir Putin's speech at the Munich Security Council in 2007, where he said, the U.S. is a monopoly in terms of foreign affairs, and that is not healthy for the world. And we strive to be a counterweight to the U.S., and we hope that it becomes, again, a multipolar world.
Julia, at this point, is Russia more friend or foe to the United States?
More foe, for sure. I think at this point, the gloves have really come off. You know, when I was just in Russia, this is how people familiar with the thinking inside the Kremlin put it to me, that after Ukraine, where Putin really believes that the CIA organized a coup against the elected pro-Russian leader Viktor Yanukovych, after the leak of the Panama Papers, which were very embarrassing to Putin, after the leaks about the World Anti-Doping Agency and the banning of Russian Olympians from the Summer Olympics in 2016, the gloves have come off. And I had one person who's quite close to the Kremlin explain to me that, look, in Russia, fairness is the most important thing. If we think something is unfair, we'll go above the law. And that's at all levels of society, from, you know, traffic laws to international law. So they're saying, okay, if you want to fight dirty, we can fight dirty.
Julia Yaffe is a staff writer for The Atlantic. Thanks so much, Julia.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, remembering the life and work of Mexican journalist Javier Valdez. You're with The World. I'm Carol Hills, and you're with The World. In Mexico, human rights activists are demonstrating today. They're expressing their outrage over the killing of yet another prominent Mexican journalist. Javier Valdez was an investigative reporter who covered drug cartel violence in his home state of Sinaloa. He was murdered yesterday. We'll hear more about Javier Valdez and his work in a moment, but first we turn to the New York Times' Paulina Villegas in Mexico City. Paulina, this murder of Javier Valdez in Sinaloa is part of a pattern, isn't it?
Definitely. The death of Javier Valdez is definitely a blow for the journalistic community here, but it's not some isolated event. It is, as you say, a pattern. It is more than 100 journalists have been killed since 2000. So it's definitely systematic violence perpetrated against the press here, and it's definitely getting worse. And we're very concerned and appalled, as you can imagine.
What's the response been from the Mexican government to these crimes?
There was a special federal prosecutor's office founded to investigate these crimes against journalists and activists alone, which was taken as a good faith and a good step towards stopping all this violence. Unfortunately, the results and efficiency of this office, of the prosecutor's office, has resulted and proven to be very high. Just to give you an example of 800 cases and files and investigations of not only deaths, but just attacks against journalists, only two of them have resulted in convictions. So unfortunately, the response has been inefficient in the worst.
So from all of these murders and disappearances and attacks, very few have been prosecuted effectively.
Exactly. Most crimes in Mexico, 98% of crimes go unsolved in Mexico. So, yeah, in that context, of course, journalists are killed and these cases keep piling up.
What has been the effect on journalism in Mexico? I mean, does it send a chill down the spine of reporters like you?
Yes, for sure. I think that's what kind of one of the saddest and most worrying and disconcerting part of this all. It's so discouraging. I've been listening and hearing to so much outrage and sadness, but also this motivation of Javier Valdez's death, because he was so, respected, acclaimed, well, seasoned journalist. And also the feeling is if someone like him can get killed, even after 20 years after reporting crime, then what's kind of the hope for all of the other kind of more unknown and starting, journalists around the country? And the impact in journalism has been self-censorship, first of all, which is probably the worst part of it, right? The fear of getting killed or attacked or threatened or your family getting hurt for what you're writing or not writing is the primal kind of factor when covering drug trafficking or organized crime, etc. So, yeah, the freedom of press at large and the quality of journalism and, of course, its impact in democracy, it's pretty evident.
You've been observing this a long time. People are frustrated. They're upset. What do people want the Mexican government to do?
I think the number one demand from the people and society in general is, first of all, for the federal government to actually acknowledge that this is a very big problem, both attacks against the press and activists and critics, but also the larger problem, which is the lack of rule of law and impunity and corruption that allows for this violence to keep going and only growing. That's definitely the major concern and demand from society right now.
The New York Times' Paulina Villegas in Mexico City. We wanted to know more about the life and work of slain journalist Javier Valdez, so we asked Marcela Turati to join us. She's a Mexican journalist who's also covered the country's drug cartels. Turati says she has fond memories of her friend Javier Valdez.
He was always happy, joking, even in the bad moment when he has a lot of problems in Sinaloa, when he covered the drug war. He always was helping other colleagues that come from Mexico City or foreign correspondents who want to know what's happening in Mexico and in Sinaloa, that is the land of El Chapo Guzmán and the Sinaloa cartel. He was devoted to his family. He talked a lot about his children, but he was a foreign correspondent of national newspaper, La Jornada. He co-founded a newspaper in his hometown in Sinaloa, Rio 12. He also wrote a lot of books. Almost every year he has a new book about how the narco culture shaped the lives around him. So he wrote about the widows and orphans of the drug killings.
Of those killed by the drug cartels?
Yes, about the culture, about the women and the violence.
You know, many reporters, they fly into places or they report on things that don't affect them directly. But Javier Valdez was reporting on the drug cartels that were operating, right in his hometown. And that just obviously took a lot of courage. What made him so dedicated to covering that topic?
He said that he has to talk and write about it because if nobody does, it will be worse, no? That this drug invasion is just making a lot of suffering. So he felt that it was his duty doing this. Also, he said many times that he was afraid of the corrupt politicians because they are involved in these drug cartels situation. So he always said he has to write about it, even if he was afraid. he received some awards, like CPJ, Committee of Protection of Journalists Award.
The Committee to Protect Journalists, they gave him an award.
Yes, in 2011. And we always thought that he was some kind of protected with this award.
That his status internationally would protect him.
Yes, he was. He has an international profile. But yes, yesterday when we read this news, we all were shocked because he was like us, our older brother, no? He was like the one who teaches us when we don't know in Mexico City and in other places how to cover this. He just shared with us their strategies to stay alive.
I wonder, will you continue your own reporting on drug cartels in Mexico?
Yes, obviously, yes, sure. If me or my colleagues choose being journalists in this moment, it's because we know the risk. In some way, you choose because you know that the government won't protect you, that you know that nobody will investigate your murder, and this murder will continue because the impunity is so high. So we know that if we are journalists and we help to defend this right of the information and this right of the people to know what is happening, and we just have to learn how to do it in a better way and a more safety way if it is possible, and continue. We will be in Mexico City and in other cities around in Spain and in El Salvador and in Latin America and other places. The people and other journalists will protest asking for justice.
Marcela Tarati is a reporter for the Mexican news magazine Proceso. She's also a friend of fellow journalist Javier Valdez, who was murdered yesterday in his hometown in the Mexican state of Sinaloa. Very sorry for your loss.
Thank you.
You're with the world. I'm Carol Hills. President Trump says he had the right to share sensitive information with Russian officials, but this legal expert thinks he should have known better.
We really should expect the President of the United States to understand the gravity of and consequence of sort of improperly disclosing this type of information.
That's ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. There seemed to be only one story in Washington today, the fallout from President Trump's sharing of classified information with Russia's foreign minister and ambassador. The White House is defending the president's actions as wholly appropriate, but the controversy continues to raise serious national security questions, and we'll be hearing more about that in just a few minutes. First, we turn to an event that at any other time, under any other president perhaps, might be today's top story. President Trump's meeting at the White House with his Turkish counterpart, Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Trump welcomed Erdogan as a partner and ally.
We support Turkey in the first fight against terror and terror groups like ISIS and the PKK and ensure they have no safe quarter, the terror groups.
Karim Fahim is the Istanbul bureau chief for The Washington Post. Karim, I think all of our listeners have heard of ISIS, but remind us who the PKK are and what do they want?
So the PKK, which is short for the Kurdistan Workers' Party, is a separatist group fighting for an independent Kurdish region in Turkey. It's also a transnational group. There are branches of the PKK in Iraq and elsewhere, and they've been fighting a decades-long insurgency against the Turkish state. And so the Turkish government considers this their principal enemy.
And of course, the Kurds are quite different to Turks. They have their own language and culture. But I know there's a problem in terms of how the U.S. and Turkey views the Kurds. In Syria, aren't the Kurds seen as America's friends?
Well, both the U.S. and Turkey consider the PKK to be a terrorist group. The U.S. has partnered with Syrian Kurdish fighters under a different banner, the banner of the YPG, or the People's Protection Units, to fight against the Islamic State. Now, Turkey regards that Syrian Kurdish group as an arm of their own PKK. So that's the disconnect. The U.S. has, you know, perhaps reasonably been looking for the most effective partners it can find on the ground to defeat the Islamic State. And, you know, as it has done this and strengthened this Kurdish group, that has raised fears in Turkey that that group will eventually turn its weapons and its battlefield experience against Turkey. So that's a principal disagreement between the two countries.
So in practical terms, the Turks think the U.S. is now supporting a terrorist group by arming the YPG, which they think are allies of their own internal enemy, the PKK. It's all very confusing. But did you see any evidence of the tension around that issue being addressed today between President Erdogan and President Trump?
No, in fact, the opposite. I mean, they had a very, I guess I would call it a chummy press conference. They both complimented each other. They talked about the strength of the relationship, its importance, and all the sort of potential for expanding the relationship. President Erdogan did talk about the Kurdish groups and how it would be unacceptable for Turkey, for countries to partner with those Kurdish groups. But, you know, we were expecting quite a lot of tension in advance of Erdogan's trip to the U.S. The arming of the Kurds in Syria is not the only troublesome issue between the U.S. and Turkey. There's also the matter of a Turkish cleric who lives in exile in the United States. Turkey is very anxious for the U.S. to extradite him back to Turkey. And that has also been a very difficult issue.
And that's, of course, Fethullah Gulen. He lives in Pennsylvania, and Turkey considers him the person behind the attempted coup last summer.
Yes, exactly.
Remind us how Erdogan responded to that failed military coup last summer.
Well, what followed the failed coup last July has been, you know, really a wide-ranging purge of Turkey's state institutions. Nearly 200,000 people have been either dismissed from their positions or arrested, many of them accused either directly of playing some part in the coup, but there has been criticism of the government for expanding the crackdown beyond actual sort of perceived enemies of the state to, you know, everyday sort of dissidents. Journalists have been put in prison, academics have lost their jobs. So there's been this sort of tremendous churn in Turkey.
That was Karim Fahim, Istanbul bureau chief for The Washington Post. Let's get back to our top story today, President Trump's disclosure of classified information to Russian officials. Susan Hennessy is a national security fellow at the Brookings Institution. She says there are circumstances in which it's appropriate, even necessary, for the president to disclose classified information. But Hennessy says she's not convinced this was one of those circumstances.
If Trump really did feel like this was information that was necessary to share with the Russian government for, I think he tweeted, humanitarian reasons or national security reasons, you wouldn't expect him to share it in this particular manner, right? Sort of an offhanded comment in the Oval Office. You know, you would expect there to be an opportunity for Russian officials to ask questions. It would be presented in a carefully controlled, heavily redacted format. It probably would have been a briefing that took place in a secure space. And certainly there wouldn't have been members of Russian press present as well. So sort of it would be appropriate for a president in some circumstances to share this information. But by every indicator, both about the substance of what was shared and the manner in which it was shared, it really does seem like Trump just sort of was bragging or just decided to share this without any sort of discernible benefit to the United States.
Let's go back to the whole issue of classified information. How does information get classified?
There's a relatively elaborate system. It's all dictated through executive order. So the executive order that's currently in place was actually signed by President Obama. It's called Executive Order 13526. And it sets the various levels of classification, which realm from sort of a low-level confidential up to secret, top secret, and then into various compartments of classified information. And then there are various sort of handling instructions. And within that executive order, there is the designation of particular individuals as what's known as an original classification authority. So somebody who's allowed to look at a piece of information, make the assessment about whether or not the disclosure would be harmful or grievously harmful to U.S. national security interests. And then everybody else has to adhere to that classification marking.
In this case of the information that President Trump shared, how was it classified?
So we don't know the specifics. Certainly, this is the type of information that would be classified at the highest levels. By all accounts, this is information that actually was not just classified sort of at the top secret level and above, but was actually very carefully controlled dissemination even within the United States government. So this is information of the most sensitive possible types of classification.
One question I have is, how do you determine what information needs to be classified or not? I mean, is it everyday banter? Is it information from a specific country to the U.S.? Where does it start?
The rationale for classifying information is that its disclosure would cause a particular type of national security harm. So if something would cause some national security harm, that might be classified at the secret level. Something that would cause grievous or grave national security harm, that's classified at the top secret level. And that isn't just sort of a general instinct that the original classification authority makes. They have to actually be able to articulate what harm might come to the United States in order to justify that classification.
Did President Trump, did he know of the possible harm that revealing this kind of information would have?
So that's a difficult question to answer. It's not the sort of thing that you usually have to tell a president what sort of specific harm might come. It's relatively apparent on its face. You know, we really should expect the president of the United States to understand the gravity of and consequence of sort of improperly disclosing this type of information.
Technically, the president isn't violating the law here in revealing this information to the Russians, but is he violating his oath of office?
Yeah, so this is a much broader question. Whenever President Trump assumed office, he swore to faithfully execute his office. There's all kinds of conduct that might not formally break the law, but we would still see as a sort of an egregious breach of that oath. So imagine if he tweeted out the nuclear codes. That wouldn't be a breach of any law. There's no law that says he can't do that. But we would all understand that to not be a faithful execution of his office. The articles of impeachment typically have included reference to violations of oath, and that's really where the remedy here sounds, that this is really a political question, ultimately, of when a president breaches his oath in this nature related to this kind of really significant security information. Those are the types of consequences we could possibly be talking about.
Susan Hennessy there. She's a national security fellow with the Brookings Institution. Legal or not, Trump's decision to share sensitive information with Russian officials has the potential to severely affect relations with U.S. allies. The New York Times is reporting that one of those allies, Israel, is the original source of the classified material Trump shared. Earlier today, we spoke with Richard Nephew about all this. He's a former National Security Council and State Department official who's now at Columbia University.
The United States has got a variety of different sharing arrangements with countries that can change depending on what is at issue. I mean, you could imagine intelligence sharing through NATO with NATO countries, given the closeness of our alliance there. And then, of course, there are ad hoc arrangements where you make a decision that you're going to share information on an episodic basis, all depending on mutual interests at the time. So we're heavily dependent on getting information, sharing analysis, comparing notes with our partners and allies. It's a source of strength and support for the United States.
Trump officials seem confident that this scuffle over the president sharing this sensitive intelligence with Russia won't affect America's intelligence-sharing relationships with U.S. allies. Here's National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster earlier today.
No, I'm not concerned at all. That conversation was wholly appropriate to the conversation, and I think wholly appropriate what the expectations are of our intelligence partner.
What's interesting, Richard, is that we're already hearing about potential fallout. The AP reported today that a senior European intelligence official who went unnamed said his country might stop sharing information with the U.S. I mean, should we expect to see U.S. allies making those announcements publicly?
I wouldn't expect to see them publicly. The fact, actually, that one is prepared to make that kind of statement publicly is in and of itself a damaging sign of how deeply this leak, this release of information to Russia has potentially damaged our intelligence sharing. I mean, candidly, I think that the bigger issue is that they may decide to continue formal intelligence sharing arrangements. They may continue to share low-level information. But, you know, you have to consider, if you've got the good stuff, you know, information that was very difficult to acquire, very sensitive, potentially involving sources who have put their lives at risk, are you going to risk that information to share it with the United States now? And I think it's going to lead a number of our partners and allies to ask themselves that question, which is dangerous in its own right, and then make the decision maybe not to withhold all forms of intelligence cooperation, but the most vital, the most sensitive intelligence. And that, after all, can be the most damaging thing at all to lose.
What's at stake for the U.S. and its allies if intelligence sharing drops off?
Well, I think the first and most direct impact is that we lose the ability to tap into the expertise, the resources, and the analysis of our partners and allies who might just simply know more about a particular issue or have greater insight into a particular country. And that leaves us blind. It leaves us blind from a policy perspective. We can't accurately determine what policy issues we should take if we don't know what we don't know. But then we've also, of course, got the more immediate security risks, where because of, you have to almost say, you know, inadvertent release of information to a potential hostile country, that you have the inability to learn about emergent threats, problems that are coming across the transom that governments need to deal with. And I think third, of course, you lose the potential for intelligence on Russia directly. And I think this is something we're not spending enough time talking about, but even if partners and allies are prepared to share with us information about general threats, the fact that Trump in his very first meeting with Lavrov sitting there in the Oval Office felt obliged to share very sensitive intelligence with the Russians means if I were a foreign intelligence service, I wouldn't share anything I knew about Russia, certainly nothing very sensitive, without thinking it through very carefully about what might come out the next time they're in the Oval Office.
Do you see any scenario where it might be legitimate and appropriate for the U.S. to share classified information with Russian officials in this way? I mean, as President Trump said, he's claiming he was trying to get Russia to, quote, greatly step up their fight against ISIS and terrorism.
Absolutely. Look, I have personally secured the intelligence community's permission to release intelligence to Russia. I've done it multiple times throughout my career. But the key issue is I did it the right way. I went through the process that exists to request release from the intelligence community, which includes itself a request to release intelligence from the partner services. That all happens, you know, behind the curtain. And it's really, it's a normal part of doing government, but you have to do it the right way. And I think what's most disturbing about this incident is it appears as if there was no forethought at all, that there was just a decision on the spur of the moment to share very sensitive information with a potentially hostile government without even asking for permission. And it's that kind of lack of process, lack of respect for the equities of the intelligence agencies at risk that I think is the most damaging here.
Richard Nephew served in the National Security Council and State Department during the Obama administration. He's now a researcher and professor at Columbia University. Thanks, Richard.
Thank you.
Experts across the globe are still trying to piece together who was behind last week's massive cyber attack. Today, some fingers are pointing at North Korea as the source of the WannaCry ransomware. North Korean officials haven't commented. But regardless of who unleashed the virus, it sure caused a lot of headaches for users. But as malicious and sophisticated as these attacks are, they're really not that new.
The first ransomware virus actually predates email and the internet as we know it, and was distributed on floppy disks via the postal service.
That's reporter Alina Simone, who's looked into the history of malware.
This was in 1989, and it was actually not distributed within the U.S., but it was distributed by a United States citizen.
And what kind of impact did it have on its victims? I mean, how did it play out?
The perpetrator was a Harvard-educated evolutionary biologist by the name of Joseph L. Popp, and he distributed 20,000 floppy disks to health researchers throughout the world. The Trojan that he used was actually particularly evil in that it was masquerading, this floppy disk that he sent out was masquerading as sort of an interactive survey that would help you know your risk for getting AIDS.
Wow.
Yeah.
So this was really kind of in one of the serious stages of AIDS, where education and getting people to understand what was going on was critical.
Right. And that's why I think so many people opened it, you know, because this was, you know, in the red zone of the AIDS era. And even Pop's motives are unclear. Some people sort of view him as some kind of crypto Robin Hood. His lawyers claimed that he was going to donate the proceeds from this malware fee he was collecting to alternative AIDS education programs, that he was unhappy with the way governments were responding to AIDS. Other people had a hypothesis that he was just bitter at the WHO for rejecting him to the World Health Organization, sorry, because they rejected him for a job. And the excuse that the judge ultimately bought was that he was simply insane. So that's what got him off scot-free.
So fast forward to today, and what was your reaction when you heard about the latest ransomware episode?
I was kind of surprised, and maybe echoing some of the things that we've been hearing on the news and from researchers about kind of the surprisingly amateurish level of this ransomware. I actually checked and saw that they were charging, for example, $300 in Bitcoin, I believe, which is less in today's dollars than Joseph Pop was charging in 1989, which is something like 372 or something if you look it up. But my mom was hit by ransomware a couple of years ago, and she was asked to pay $500 in Bitcoin, which she did, and she got her files back. And so at that time, I did a lot of research into the history of ransomware, and I also interviewed a lot of cybersecurity experts. And one thing that was striking about this is that the version that hit my mom, which was called CryptoWall, after she was hit by it in 2014, new versions were released, kind of like, you know, Microsoft Word releases updated versions of its software. So these new and improved versions of CryptoWall, they did things like, instead of just targeting 40 or 50 different kinds of software like Word docs, Excel docs, they started targeting everything that wasn't essential to your computer functioning, just so that they could totally lock everything and not just certain things. And then another version that came out went a step further, and it kind of analyzed the data that it was capturing and would charge you accordingly, which is extremely sophisticated, right? So it would set the ransom level based on the value of what it had stolen. And so when you compare CryptoWall 4.0 to this ransomware, it actually seems to be much less sophisticated.
What do you think is the lesson you learned in learning about all the early viruses?
I'm not sure if this is a lesson, but in connecting it with today's outbreak, this WannaCry virus, one thing that I was kind of heartened by is the fact that they haven't earned so much money. And one reason I hope that they haven't is that maybe there has been so much media exposure on ransomware, that there has been so much coverage of ransomware. Because if you think about it, this first case, it happened in 1989. That was the first ransomware virus. It was actually Scotland Yard's biggest and most expensive investigation at the time. And nobody ever heard of it, right? I mean, have you ever heard of it? This is, you know, got buried by the sands of time. And it's only been in recent years that ransomware has been in the news. And I hope what that's doing is encouraging companies and individuals and governments to really back up their data on remote drives, because that is the insurance that kills ransomware. So, you know, I don't know if that's a silver lining for you, but those are some final thoughts at least.
Reporter Alina Simone telling us a little bit about the early types of malware. Thanks a lot, Alina.
Thanks, Carol.
Yes, now we know. Back up that data again, again, and again. And if you can't stand the heat, though, get out of the kitchen or go to Sweden. This is the Swedish trio Vossen. They do non-traditional, traditional music. And this little tune from their just-released CD is called Sommarpolskan, a summer polka. Polkas are a mainstay in Swedish traditional music, but since Vossen is a non-traditional traditional ensemble, this is a twist on the old-school polka. For starters, Vossen's guitarist, Roger Tallroth, composed this summer polka in the winter and in the middle of a high fever. Or so he claims. As you can hear, even in the depths of winter, Vossen heats up the party. Off Vossen's latest CD, Brood. The word Vossen in Swedish means many things. It signifies spirit or noise or a living being. Vossen has been making music for 27 years, and in that sense, they're not just brood, they're nicely aged. We leave you with more from Sommar Polsken. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. Thanks for being with us.
Public Radio International.